The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
That for me is the iconic score.
Right. Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I'm joined by my co-host, albeit remotely, SBS channel manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey Ben, are you there?
Hey Fee, I am here. I know that you spent the last weekend heavily involved in a round of nude drawing.
Yeah, you could say that. Yes, I was involved in the production of Life Drawing Live, running website duties on that, and PoseCam, if people are aware of that. So that was the Australian version of Life Drawing Live, but we've got another couple coming up on SBS in the next 2 weeks, which are the UK versions of the same thing. So I hope you're all drawing all the nude models and improving your art skills in this pandemic.
Yeah, it was a very enjoyable activity. I had a household full of people all drawing nudes, not drawing in the nude, just to clarify that. Yeah, that was a good way to start the week. And speaking of the week, let's take a look at what we've got ahead. So we have Lin-Manuel Miranda breaking with history in the Disney Plus release of his Broadway hit Hamilton. And we're checking out America to Me and Disclosure in What Have You Been Watching? And War of the Worlds and the works of composer Ennio Morricone as our weekly picks on SBS On Demand.
There's a lot. Let's get into it.
The Hamilton, let's start there, sort of huge Broadway hit. Were you buying T-shirts, flying off to Broadway or the West End for a front row seat?
Sadly, no.
Singing along to the soundtrack? No?
No, I wasn't lucky enough to have seen it live. You know, I'm aware of it as a cultural moment, but, you know, hadn't experienced it myself. Until now, and now it's in my lounge room. I can stream it. So, now I've fixed that. So now I can understand what all the fuss has been about.
Yeah, I feel like I'm on the same page. Why don't we hear a bit of the tunes that have made this show so famous?
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain.
Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
So for those who don't know, and, you know, this is a period of history fairly unfamiliar to me.
Same.
To be honest, I felt going in, oh, this must be easier for Americans to follow because, you know, at least they've studied some of this history in school. But I listened to an interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator and star of the musical Hamilton, and he was talking about how when the show moved to the UK, people said, oh, will they get it because they don't know American history? And his big point was, Americans don't know their own history. Don't take that for granted. So there's a lot to get your head around in terms of who these people are and the role that they played. But broadly, Alexander Hamilton was a immigrant, as is sort of made clear through the show, to the US. And he had an important role as particularly someone who had a real gift with the written word, with first the War of Independence against the British, and then kind of setting up this new country, and he was the first head of the Treasury and had a formative role in setting up Wall Street. So this all sounds very dry.
Super fun.
But I suppose the point of this show is it's a history lesson that is anything but dry.
Absolutely, yeah. No, the skill is making all of what you just explained then interesting, and beyond that, exciting. Yeah, and like it is a musical, wall-to-wall music. There's no spoken elements in this.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of elements that I guess sort of make this feel quite groundbreaking, that gave it this level of attention when it launched in 2015. And that is, firstly, to have all these white characters, the founding fathers, played by people of colour. And the second is the influence of particularly hip-hop in the music. And, I mean, there's hip-hop, there's strong elements of slam poetry, and there's sort of also sort of more traditional kind of show tune musical numbers. All of those have influenced Lin-Manuel Miranda, who broke through with his first musical, In the Heights, which was a bit more autobiographical, about the Puerto Rican community in Washington Heights, sort of north of Harlem, but more recently became very well known for the songs that he wrote for the Disney musical Moana, and has kind of been a kind of recurring guest on the talk show circuit. So his renown has grown, and I think he is very brilliant, and his use of language and wordplay is really what makes a lot of these songs really special.
I totally agree on that. Yeah, and just the skill for the cast to be able to, like, there's a lot packed in. Like you say, it's got roots in hip hop, so it's a 2.5 hour, I think it is. You know, just the deliveries, and you know, you need to catch up, especially if you don't know the subject matter. You're trying to understand the plot points. Like, it's amazing, and it's like, you do hang on their every word. But the diversity, I guess, is the word I'm trying to find in the range of music that's on the stage is really refreshing. It's something we haven't seen, and like, I get what the fuss was about now.
Yeah, I think sort of as a film production, this is sort of pretty bare bones. It sort of feels to me like maybe sort of about 5 cameras, kind of a sort of wide shot and a couple of angles from the side. And then, you know, you can sort of tell that they've done some Steadicam close-up stuff without an audience, but predominantly it's all been filmed with an audience.
Yeah, and you hear them at various points. You do hear some audience.
Yeah.
Big claps and laughs at certain line delivery and whatnot. I think they shot it over 3 nights, 3 performances. But, yeah, there's one where it looks like the camera's actually on stage, and I'm thinking, what's that,
yeah,
like?
Yeah, I think they've cheated that stuff a little bit.
Yeah.
But broadly, I think it's fair to say I've seen more elaborate films of stage productions than this.
Uh-huh.
I think this is sort of just really trying to give you the experience of what it's like to be in the audience more than anything. And I would say that it probably suffers a little bit from, again, just not having that live experience, so that there's sort of maybe a degree of separation, I felt, just sort of having this live production mediated by the screen. But that's a sort of small quibble.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's making any pretense that it's like a film adaptation of the story. It's literally they are filming the production. And, of course, you know, we do get in cinemas when we get to go to cinemas, we get like the National Theatre Productions come and do the rounds of cinemas here, and I think they do really well, especially for shows that don't travel. Yeah, and I think if you hear it's like a filmed play, you might think, oh, it's a camera up the back and it's like fixed or something. Like there is a lot of multi-cameras as we're getting to. So, yeah, I think for the fact that it is filming a play on stage, it is quite a vibrant production. So I've seen a lot of talk of, you know, especially on Twitter, where else, but that, you know, hopefully this can lead to more of the film productions, or everyone should just go through their archives to find more filmed plays. But it's like, I mean, this one's Disney money, and like, I think it was, you know, it's quite an undertaking to have filmed 3 different versions of it, to cut it all together, to make it this much of a production. So while, you know, to what you were saying, like, yes, there's areas where it could have felt a little more alive. I think this probably raises the standard as well for what people might expect of seeing quote-unquote filmed plays.
Yeah. No, it's a good reminder, actually, what you said about the popularity of film stage productions now in cinemas, that it's a sort of central part of the movie business now, particularly for independent cinemas. And I guess it's sort of also a reminder of the fact that we're, you know, cinemas are coming back, but we're still locked out of theatres for the moment.
Yep.
And, you know, not only does that have an impact on our arts industry, but we're being deprived of these fantastic productions. So it is a time for us where hopefully we can access more of those, a reminder that there is an opportunity to access them. For example, yeah. I saw last year the Muriel's Wedding musical with music from Kate Miller-Heidke and loved it. And that's something I would love to be able to see on a screen again.
Mm. See, I haven't. Muriel's Wedding is one of my all-time favourites, so I've sort of been a little bit reluctant to see how it might be translated. But, yeah, okay, that gives me hope that you loved it. So I hope to see it one day.
Yeah, no, I heartily recommend it. Lin-Manuel Miranda, I think, is a brilliant writer and composer. I would say he's sort of pulled off the Jerry Seinfeld technique here of surrounding himself with performers with a greater level of talent than himself. So his singing range is not, and the tone of his voice is not the same as, on the same level as some of those other supporting cast. But some of the supporting cast are really extraordinary performers.
They're incredible. Yeah, just some of the numbers. And, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It was so, yeah, I mean, he's good, but then, you know, a couple of numbers that come and just blow things out of the water. And also, I mean, with Hamilton, this has always plagued the production that, well, it plagues any kind of anything that claims to be history. He's taken some liberties in the adaptation as well in telling the life of Alexander Hamilton. So watch it knowing it's a dramatization of a life. It's not all in all a history lesson in and of itself. So it illuminates moments of history. But, yeah, I think it always shooting, you know, like a film is never the perfect record of the times in which that it's depicting. Yeah, it's a good impulse to then go read up about the people in more detail.
It's made me more interested than I ever thought I would be in that period of American history.
Yeah.
But I think there's a criticism that it plays into the sort of great man, you know, kind of version of history. And I don't completely buy that, because I think that criticism indicates that, you know, if you are coming from a progressive perspective, you shouldn't tell these stories at all, which to me then just seeds the ground to conservative storytellers. Mm. So I think there's definitely a role for a revisionist take on these significant figures of history, which this definitely is. I think there's another criticism which maybe has more weight, that Lin-Manuel Miranda minimises some of the damaging things that Alexander Hamilton did, like contributing to genocide of Native Americans and sort of perhaps underplays the contribution of some of these founding fathers to slavery, although sort of slavery is a subject that does get raised and talked about within the musical.
Yeah, it doesn't interrogate that at all. And, yeah, that's what I was sort of getting at, that, you know, he married into a family that was known to have slaves, and that's not at all addressed. But Lin-Manuel Miranda has said nothing's off the table to be criticised. But, yeah, it's important to take it, watch the film, but also read up and just get a more well-rounded understanding, I think.
Yeah, and I think I have to give a lot of credit for that choice to cast people of colour in these leading roles. And I think despite the fact that there are some real stars that he's cast, I think Leslie Odom Jr. as Aaron Burr I thought was incredible, and David Diggs has sort of become a bit of a star out of this as well, who plays dual roles, including Thomas Jefferson. But what it does is it's more than colourblind casting, and I have a lot of problems with that term. But, you know, sort of maybe I would describe this as colour-conscious casting, and it does give an opportunity for performers where, you know, if there's this sense of having to cast a historical inaccuracy, these performers wouldn't get that opportunity. But then I think it does make you, because of the colour of their skin, it foregrounds race and issues like slavery in a way that goes beyond the text of the musical yeah. itself. And I don't want to sort of completely defend the musical, but I think that race and issues like slavery are ever present purely because of who we're seeing on the stage. And I think the final song is about who tells your story through history, and the play is very conscious about who is it that tells our history, from what perspective are we being told these stories. So I don't think it tries to hide from that.
Yeah, no, I think it's all part of the conversation. There's actually a really good quote from Christopher Jackson, who plays the George Washington role. I'll just read it in full.
Like, and he's very good too. I pay for him.
Yeah. He's, when I was thinking of The Mean Set of Pipes, like it's he's certainly some of them. Renee Elise Goldsberry is amazing too. But Christopher Jackson says on the casting, it was a very powerful choice to take the idea of these men and present them through the bodies and vessels of black and brown actors. It represents the fact that our role in building this country has never truly been acknowledged, and I think it opened up the audience's minds to the spirit of what these men meant, even if they were woefully incapable of living it out in their own experiences. Thought that was a good encapsulation.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose, at the end of the day with a musical, if you're stuck with the tunes playing around and around in your head for days afterwards, then you must be onto a winner, and that's certainly the case with me.
Yeah.
So that's Hamilton, and it's out now on Disney Plus. So tap your toes along to that one.
So now we come to the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching. Ben, what have you been watching?
Well, I feel like I can't get away from the subject of race at the moment. But I am going to recommend a 10-part documentary series that I just watched over the weekend on Stan. It's from a couple of years ago. It's called America to Me, and it's made by Steve James, the American filmmaker best known for Hoop Dreams, the much beloved, again, another film about race, about young African-American basketball players attempting to break into the NBA. And really, he's made a career out of telling stories about race and social justice around his native Chicago. And this series follows a number of students that attend the Oak Park High School over 1 year of their schooling. And they're a mix of different ages in different years, but they are all black students. And this area is quite interesting because it's had a reputation as being a very progressive part of the US, this particular area, and having a very integrated school. But you begin to see through the series that a lot of that is fairly superficial, and actually the issue of American segregation sits deeper within this school experience. So that the school has a sort of tracking system. I think we might call it streams in Australia, but sort of different academic levels. And the normal level here at the school, they call college prep. So sort of the idea that you're sort of preparing yourself for college, but then they have honours level and they have AP, which is sort of the kind of advanced academic program as well. And even though the school is 50-50 white and people of colour students, the higher level academic levels are dominated by white students and the college prep level is dominated by black students. And a lot of the teachers talk about the phenomenon of white flight occurring within the school itself, so that white parents don't want their students to share classes with black students because of this idea that it'll drag down their academic performance. And the outcome of this, and what gives rise to the documentary in the first place, is that there's a growing gap between the academic outcomes of white students in the school and black students in the school. So for a school that sort of prides itself, and an area that prides itself on racial equality and integration, this is a bit of a wake-up call, and this drives the documentary. But what you get is almost a lot of documentaries in one. So one thing that astounded me is the amount of resources in this school, and there's about, I think, 3,000 students drawn from a very wide area. So I think that's a very different experience to our Australian education system. So you kind of imagine it's actually having a lot of high schools combined because they're all coming from a wider dispersed area. And it means, you know, they have a big stadium for their football team. They have big gyms. They have all these different programs. They have like a slam poetry program, and there's almost a whole documentary within the documentary of the slam poetry team going up to the national champs. And there's almost a kind of bring it on storyline with the cheerleading team. And fascinatingly, there are kind of two cheerleading teams, and one's predominantly white and one's predominantly black within the same school. But at the end, what really draws you in is these characters and these sort of, you know, really beautiful young students, so passionate, a lot of them coming from a lot of disadvantage. Their parents have made a lot of sacrifices to get them to this school. They're just very sweet, and their stories are very heartbreaking in some cases, and you really want them to succeed. And I found myself being completely hooked and having to watch all 10 hours in one sitting.
Wow, that really speaks to it, doesn't it? And sorry, where did you say we can watch it?
That's all out on Stan. And I know I've spoken already a lot about this, but the other key characters are the teachers and the inner workings of the politics within the teachers and the management of the school. We talked about sort of a few episodes ago, bad education, and there's elements of that that you see here, sort of maybe not the same level of corruption, but certainly this feeling of disconnection between a lot of what the teachers are trying to achieve and what the kind of school at the management sort of superintendent school board level are trying to do.
Yeah. You know, when you were describing it, I thought of that as well when you were saying sort of the white flight element of they're not getting the right grades or the neighbourhood or something. It doesn't reflect well on them to have their kids attending this school. I went straight to to bad education, our conversation there.
Completely. And in bad education, you know, it's fictionalised, but it was based on a real story. But the school board was heavily invested in trying to maintain property prices in the local area. And that's a real consideration in this as well. And there's a lot of frustration from some members of the school community that there's an obsession with building a new swimming pool for the high school, because this is a fairly wealthy area for the most part. Wealthy white families live here. And there's this real fear that if they don't provide all these facilities for wealthy white families, that those families will end up sending their kids to private schools and this public school is going to miss out. So there is this obsession with what can we do to look after the kind of wealthy, gentrified members of our community. And then there's a kind of policing of what happens with some of these poorer black students, who some of whom, there's a fear that some of these are coming from inner city Chicago or Southside Chicago into this area and don't actually belong. It's just a lot of elements of what we're seeing play out in the US writ large.
Yeah. No, it sounds like there'd be a lot of coded conversations as well, like the use of terms like inner city kids. And like it sounds like the conversations would be quite interesting to observe.
Yeah. I mean, it was filmed about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just a reminder, you know, all the kids are wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts, you know, that's been a long struggle and maybe gaining a bit of momentum for change now, but it's still very, very relevant. Mm. I think I may have made it sound a bit like homework, and it came up on a list of, you know, I think there's a lot of lists going around at the moment of content you should watch. And the point that the critic made was that this show sounds like it might be homework, but it's not. You know, it's really, it's just a very compelling human story. Mm. So that is America to Me, and that is streaming now on Stan. And Fee, what have you been watching?
Well, this is probably a good segue from yours, actually. Speaking of documentaries that might on paper read like homework, but are really compelling and vibrant. I watched Disclosure, which is on Netflix. And this is a one-off doc, like it's feature-length documentary, that looks at representation of the trans community on screen, so through movies and TV shows. And in doing that, it shows the real impact, the real world impact, how the trans community is represented on screen. So, yeah, as I say, so more than reflecting social attitudes, it really does show how from the start of movies, start of moving pictures, representing from movies with scenes of cross-dressing all the way through up to present day with series like Pose, it shows all examples of how trans characters on screen in the best and worst ways are depicted. And it really expertly uses montages. So there's a lot of scene after scene after scene, bad representations of either cross-dressing characters or trans people that have really long-lasting impacts and just feed this negative perception of what a trans person is, because it also makes the point that there's not a lot of visibility in the community. So for many people, watching something like Boys Don't Cry or watching a film or a really bad procedural TV show, that might represent your viewer's only experience of seeing a trans character. And for a person who is trans, it might be the only other person they see who's like them. And if that's really negative, then for all of the audience, it can really breed some horrific stereotypes. So there's representatives of the trans community on screen. So there's writers, directors, actors, and it's executive produced by Laverne Cox, who we all know from Orange is the New Black, but a leading activist and spokesperson for the community. But also some of her forebears. So there's an actress called Candace Kane, who she's had to play a lot of the terrible, bodies on the slab, quite frankly, in procedural. So like a Law and Order and SVU, just that, the long line of American US cop shows. And she's very frank and really candid about having to be in the scene where there are really negative comments being made by the detectives and whatnot, who just kind of treat a trans character in a really negative way. So putting her, being able to tell her own story about what it's like to be in that room and what it's like to play those characters is really illuminating. So I can't recommend this highly enough. It's warm and it is quite funny, but it's extremely confronting. But broadly, it's got that message of just letting people tell their story and just filling the gaps to show just how to tell a story well,
Yeah. I wonder if there's more willingness currently for people to hear stories from people outside of their own direct experience and their own worldview. I'd like to think so.
I hope so, yeah.
I guess that what's really important is that media outlets give space to those stories, sort of where perhaps once upon a time they may not have done, or they may have done, as you're saying, as Disclosure demonstrates, in a harmful way.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then, of course, in recent years there has been a bit of a trend more to more inclusive storytelling. So you do get shows like Pose, which has trans actors on screen. And I guess the part of the point is as well, in some of the spate of films, just the trend of having cis actors play a trans character, like Jared Leto winning his Oscar and Hilary Swank winning her Oscar, both for playing trans characters, and just reinforcing that damaging trope that in some way it's performative to be trans, or, it's not really authentic. So just it really unpicks a lot of that. So I just encourage people to watch it, and it might just fill in some of the blanks you might have had if, you're just not really sure. Just watch it and really learn from it. I think it's a really open-minded documentary that it's kind of like a You Can't Ask That in some ways. It just really, frankly, puts it all out there to just start a conversation, which can only be a good thing, I think.
Well, I love You Can't Ask That, so I'm sure I will love Disclosure. And where can I find it, Fee?
Oh, that one is on Netflix.
Great. So now it's time to talk about some of the many, many gems that we like to uncover each week on SBS On Demand. And I would like to kick off with a new show that's launching this week that is remake, I guess, of an old favourite known as War of the Worlds.
That can be right.
What is it?
There's no naturally occurring phenomena that can produce a signal like this.
On Wednesday, Dr. Catherine Durand of the Radio Astronomy Millimetric detected a powerful signal. All the evidence suggests that the signal is indicative of intelligent extraterrestrial life.
Does this mean that they're a threat?
On a une multitude d'objets en approche.
There's no evidence to suggest that. Surely it would be wrong to assume they aren't a threat.
The government has responded by declaring a state of emergency.
The voiture a assez d'essence?
Taxi!
Take this, please. Just go. Mom?
Do something!
What are you doing here?
You gotta come with me right now. Qu'est-ce qui se passe?
Il va y avoir une attaque.
So I know you've seen the first few eps, right, Fee?
Yes, I've seen a couple of them, yeah. And a little shout out, I did an interview with the showrunner of the show, so there's an article up at SBS Guide if you want to read that.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, well, you might know sort of some of the thinking behind it better than I do then, but I think that there is a bit of a story that the H.G. Wells estate went into the public domain a few years back, and immediately a number of productions went into development in order to exploit that still very, very popular and identifiable IP. So we did get last year a British production which was sort of set in the period in which War of the Worlds was written that didn't seem to sort of make too much of a splash, but it was sort of arguably sort of more closely related to the text of the book, whereas this sort of really uses just the concept of interplanetary invasion as a kicking off point to tell pretty much a brand new story. And the creator, Howard Overman, that you spoke with, he would be known to viewers for shows like Misfits that he previously created.
Yep.
And this is, I guess, sort of what we're increasingly seeing, which is a sort of trans-European production with the UK and France involved. And in part for that reason, it sort of splits the storytelling across those two countries and with a cast drawn from both French and British actors.
Yeah. Now, when the aliens arrive and attack, we do see responses both sides of the channel.
I think, this is sort of a moody drama. I think it does demonstrate a little bit of the kind of limitations of its budget. If you're expecting like full extravagant, sort of the Steven Spielberg War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise. This is not it. It quickly becomes a much more psychological drama about the few survivors and the lengths that they need to go to in order to live under this ever-present threat. And I suppose, there's parallels to be drawn with the current pandemic and the way in which there's a lot of fear about stepping into this world that we're living in that I think we all can identify with.
Yeah, I'll draw on the conversation a bit, but even when I was chatting to him about it, he was saying that this is all pre-pandemic, obviously, when it was made and when it first came out, but he said he was doing press for it and everyone was saying, oh, is it a Brexit metaphor or is it a climate change metaphor? And the beauty of the source material is yes and yes and yes. It's all of it, really. So any kind of existential threat you perceive, it works for it. So, if you're worried about coronavirus, and aren't we all, part of the beauty of the concept is it's you can really put yourself in the place of the characters in the show and just think, you know, if the aliens attack right now, literally what do I do? I'm right here. How do I get where I need to get to safety? Like you can interrogate just your exit plan if you need to in a scary way.
Yeah, I think cast members that viewers will recognise, Gabrielle Byrne is one in one of the lead roles, Elizabeth McGovern from Downton is one of the leads, and then the very hot right now, Daisy Edgar-Jones from Normal People, viewers will also recognise.
And the French cast, there's Léa Drucker who... you would know her face from a lot of French films. Yeah, so there's an all-star cast of people fleeing the aliens. like you were saying, like it plays up more the drama than the special effects. It's not a huge CG extravaganza. It's kind of the tactic, again, with Spielberg, but with Jaws, you know, he didn't show the shark immediately and that was kind of a budget thing, but also it worked dramatically to not show the shark so soon. But, yeah, the idea of what are these aliens like is... does linger across the first couple of episodes where you just know the threat, you don't actually know what they look like, which, yes, it ratchets up the tension. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, so episodes are going out from Thursday, 9th of July, and there'll be two episodes in the first week, otherwise they'll be dropping weekly after that. So that's Thursdays starting 8:30 and then going to 9:30 on SBS or up on SBS On Demand. So, yeah, I encourage people to check it out.
Absolutely.
And for film fan as you are, there was another great loss in the industry this week.
Yes. Very sad news. We lost Ennio Morricone, the late great film composer, whose credits are too numerous to mention. But, yes, sadly he passed on. He was 91, had a good run, but yeah, nonetheless, quite sad. But I'm always loving the tributes that flow once there's a big loss, and yeah, there's just really warm remembrances from all sectors of the film industry because his list of credits, you know, his resume, I guess, is what the word I'm seeking, across so many genres and countries, and yeah, he just composed so many films and a whole lot more that you may not be aware of that I wasn't aware of. Yeah, just big loss.
And, yeah, huge talent. And I know a favourite thing of yours to do is to revisit a title or two from one of these creators if we're sad enough to lose them. And what's caught your eye in terms of Ennio Morricone's work?
Yes, well... of course, I look to see what we've got at SBS On Demand. Just kind of like, what have we got? I need to watch something. So it's a list. It's not a comprehensive list, it must be said. It's not the Mission or the Untouchables or the Good, Bad, the Ugly, but or Hateful Eight.
Which, have you gone for deep cuts?
Yes, that's why it's been. We've gone for the deep cuts because everyone's watching the others. well played. So we've got Once Upon a Time in the West. So there is a spaghetti western there. Absolutely dive in and enjoy the wonderful score of that. It's beautiful. We've got Bugsy, which was one of the films he was nominated for an Oscar, because famously he only won his Oscar a couple of years ago when it was for The Hateful Eight, which is a brilliant score, by the way, for Quarantino.
That's Quentin a good Tarantino's. Name for a movie season for the time being.
The Quarantino, yeah. For Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. And while I've digressed, it always struck me that year of the Oscars that Twitter was focused on will Leo finally win his Oscar, which he did, but it was like, Ennio Morricone has not won an Oscar yet. Like, let's not all get in a flap about Leo finally winning his Oscar. It's like, Ennio finally won his.
True.
Right? Anyway, they both walked away winners, so it's fine. So where was I? Bugsy, Warren Beatty's sweeping biopic of Bugsy Siegel. We've got that at SBS On Demand.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah, great score. And we've also got The Best Offer, which is a film by Giuseppe Tornatore, who Morricone worked with before he did the I'm Gonna Cry soundtrack for Cinema Paradiso, if you remember. Yeah, so they were frequent collaborators. So we've got The Best Offer. And just for something different, we've also got Danger Diabolique, which is a hell of a watch. It's Mario Bava's 60s, how do I even start to describe this? But it's kind of like a James Bond spoof, I guess, is a way to spin it. Well, you remember Danger 5, the SBS series?
Yeah.
Yes. Owes very much to Danger Diabolique. It's all miniatures and, you know, kooky 60s music. Yeah, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it's a wild ride and the music to match, so...
I'm in. You've won me over.
There you go. You're welcome. So, yeah, they're the ones we've got at SBS On Demand, and I encourage you to watch all the others, you know, like the greats, like The Mission. Again, he didn't win an Oscar for that, but The Untouchables, The Good, Bad, The Ugly. Yeah.
Yes.
Go on,
I feel like that for me is the iconic score.
Right. Yeah. But I remember at school, The Mission, that music to me takes me back to school rather than to the movie, because we had compulsory reading time that always piped that music over the AV to signal the start and finish of our reading time, rather than have someone come over on the AV and say, start your reading, finish your reading. We'd play the beautiful strains of The Mission soundtrack.
Oh, right.
So that's how I remember
the influence that school had on you, Fee.
Yeah, the music or from the movies that had the impact on me in school. More like.
Great. Well, I think jump into the podcast notes to see the list of all those titles, but otherwise jump straight into SBS On Demand and seek those out.
Yes. All right.
Well, that's it for the show for the week. Make sure you listen to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a lot of stars and leave us a nice review, because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fiki.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot. Until next week.
Thanks for listening.